Okay, anyhow, I just I wanted to tell a little bit about things I did in connection with spintronics, and because it also has something to do with superconductors, I flashed here the title Super Spintronics, which so the talk is, since all this was planned just like 24 hours ago, is a bit not so well prepared. It consists of two parts. One part is some overview talk, which reflects basically the state of the field and let's say roughly a year ago. And then I have one other part, which is something which we did, which was kind of builds on the previous on this part, which we did in the last years. And as usually, if you if somebody says I'm kind of giving an overview talk over the state of the field, it means I give an overview over the state of my works in the field, because other things are much too complicated, much too long. Okay, so we. First, I should acknowledge all people whom, with whom I collaborated on various topics here, Yuli Nazarov, and I forgot, of course, to mention also Gerrit Bauer here in this this talk. We also had some work, which, but I will not talk on this work. That's why it's not in this list.
I'm not offended.
Okay, so mainly... there's a much work done by Audrey Cote here, which is now in... yeah, okay, so this is the same. Okay, I mean, this is a list of people. Many of them are, in the meantime, at other places than listed here, and you will see the names later again. So the outline is, I want to say, since this is not, I think people are not so familiar with this superconductor ferromagnet heterostructures here, I want to give some general motivation, and then I want to cover basically three small topics which are related, but one is, say, the so-called density of states oscillations in superconductor ferromagnet heterostructures, then pi Josephson junctions, and it will make clear what I mean with this pi, which appear in SFS structures, and then I have a part about supercurrent through a quantum dot, a single spin quantum dot, which consists of maybe we also have some work. I will not talk about this part here. And okay, so what is the general motivation? I mean, we all know that superconductors are quite interesting macroscopic quantum objects, so they are characterized by kind of a macroscopic a wave function, which and the most peculiar property of this wave function is that it has a phase, of course, and so it's in kind of a macroscopic phase state, characterized by a constant phase all over. And on the other hand, if you look into the spin structure of these superconductors, there's not much going on, because these are just the spin singlets, and so there's, say, from the spin side of view, there's nothing special about the superconductor. Then I... on the other hand, ferromagnets are kind of a quantum spin state, so there's a macroscopic a spin, and with and in this sense, but of course there's no phase coherence required, and in this sense this is a quite a different a quantum state than this superconducting state, but still it's also a quantum state, because we need this spin, otherwise we would not have a ferromagnetism. Okay, and so the ideas of, or the question is now, what happens if we bring these two effects together into typically into a heterostructure? So this was first, addressed. What happens if we have kind of superconductivity and magnetism at the same time? This was addressed like 40 years ago already. by these in these works. So we know that in a superconductor, we have a pairing of two electrons in Cooper pairs, and we have a pairing of states at with a wave factor k spin up and a wave factor minus k and spin down, so that the total momentum is zero. This is something, in some sense, a Cooper pair, this pair of states, or these two electrons together, and this binding is by phonons, but we don't really care about the mechanism. On the other hand, if we think about a magnet in a simple, very simple stoner model, we just have this shifted bands, but this means that at the Fermi energy, which is here, this is also at the Fermi energy, it's kind of the Fermi sphere here, that these two spin states have actually different momentum, okay, or different k vectors. So if we want to pair these states, because we have to pair them because they are, to get a singlet, we have to take these different spin states, then we will have to pair these states which are kind of different, have different momenta, and this was recognized by these gentlemen, that we can take make also a pairing then, where these k's are shifted by some vector q in the same direction, and this q is actually related to the difference in wave vectors at the Fermi energy of these two spins. And if you just in the stoner model, this 2 times q is just given by 2 times the exchange energy, assuming that it's small compared to the Fermi energy, divided by h bar over vf. So this defines a wave vector, or an inverse length, which we call 1 over xi f, which is a characteristic length scale related to this pairing of electrons into Cooper pairs in ferromagnets. And it, since now all pairs, so we all always have to pair the states with are kind of characterized by by the same q for all positions on the Fermi surface. It turns out that the macroscopic wave function actually gets a structure, and we can kind of structure it in two ways with this q. Either we make kind of a standing wave, which has this period or this wave number 2q, or you can look at let's say a plane wave, that this wave macroscopic wave function gets a space dependent phase, and of course you see that this kind of gives a structure in the pair amplitude, a spatial structure, whereas this thing is kind of a moving a plane wave, so it carries a current, yeah. So we will expect, therefore, that this ferromagnetism will have a strong effect on this kind of the spatial pair wave function, or on the supercurrent.
And this which one should be chosen?
It's an open question. So in these works, they have shown that in a bulk system, I just want to show that these kinds, both we can have this, which means we influence the supercurrent by this q, and this means we get a spatial variation, yeah, because this has a constant modulus. And in fact, in bulk system, it's more complicated because they are three-dimensional and so on. This phase is realized, because this would mean a macroscopic current in a bulk phase, which is of course not so likely. But it's still a matter of debate. I think there's no way to determine this. You basically choose a trial wave function, calculate the free energy, and you find that this has a small.
Sometimes there is a lot of papers claiming observation of low phase.
They have always been, but
still under dispute.
I think there is still under dispute. I don't know this. There are. But I want to show you that you can in kind of these heterostructures, for example, because they, if you put something together, this defines a certain q. If you have a certain geometrical length, yeah, then you can directly probe this spatial structure, for example, or the effect onto the supercurrent. Okay, this directly brings me to how to detect this. And in it, it has so the disadvantage in the bulk is that you the thermodynamic properties are almost unchanged. You don't really see this, and because you have this spatial structure, and if you now of course at this order. Now we know that for normal superconductors it doesn't matter, but now if you have the spatial structure, it will of course matter, and it will destroy it. And this is probably the main reason why it has not been observed, because it's sensitive to surface disorder and so on. And okay, and this is where these heterostructures come into play, because here the one can separate this magnetization from the superconducting order, so you also do not destroy the superconductor by adding this. This magnetization, and also one gets this kind of automatically this spatial resolution, because if you think about a ferromagnet which is attached to a superconductor, then this Cooper pair wave functions may extend into this ferromagnet, and this defines kind of a direction on which we kind of will see this spatial oscillation, this finite Q.
So penetration length will be inverse Q.
Yes. And this is in fact already the first kind of way to observe this is to look at kind of this. I should have put a plot here, or I mean, this is now we just have a superconductor on one side, a ferromagnet on the other side, and this is our coordinate x. Yeah, so just and now we just look at the superconducting properties. For example, one can check look at the local density of states as a function of distance here, and then one can calculate or estimate that the density of states, which in the BCS is just given by this gap form, this is only for energies above delta, will get such a spatial structure, the density of states as a function of energy. So if I probe it with the kind of, for example, one could probe it with a tunneling a microscope, making spectroscopy to get the energy dependence and the spatial resolution, and there are actually experiments done in that direction.
It's different from the usual proximity effect. Here appears this cosine.
Exactly.
And exponential usual for proximity.
Exactly.
Cosine is specific for
one. Exactly. So what you get is then that you get this is exactly this cosine 2qr, which I have shown you previously. Yeah? So x over xi f. And you get a damping in addition. And this is similar in the normal metal, but in the normal metal you don't have the cosine, you have a temperature dependent damping. Okay, and now this has actually been observed some like 5 years ago by Kontos and others. So they did exactly this. They made such a structure, and then they kind of made a spectroscopy as a function of distance. And then what they observed is, for depending on the distance, they observed tunneling spectra which look like a BCS superconductor, or if they kind of changed the distance, so they could not change it continuously, but they had to make a separate sample each time. But then they saw that this is exactly inverted. So you have this is a BCS, I mean, roughly similar to the BCS density of states, washed out, of course. And then at a larger distance, this was exactly flipped. Okay? And now you can map out this oscillation by looking at this value at zero, at the Fermi energy, as a function of distance. And then they sort of found this oscillation, yeah. So this is as a function of this x over xi f. It starts with zero in the gap case, increases, and then it oscillates only once, because we have seen that it decays on the same length scale as the oscillation. So it's maybe not so easy. It's not so easy to detect.
Shouldn't there be an angular average over the cube somehow that washes out this oscillation? why does it so?
Yeah, yeah, no, this is, I mean, kind of, this of course includes all the angular average. This is another reason why it's kind of washed out or small. But it's
surprising that anything happens
it's,
at all.
No, because it's like, we had this already before, that, I mean, this return again in this talk by Arne, I think, or about this you have oscillations with different length scale, but they all start at the same x. So you have this, and then you have.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you in average over all this, what remains is a damped oscillation which oscillates on the same scale as it decays. And this is exactly how you get this cosine times this, essentially. Yeah, I mean. Okay, so this is the measurement here, and then we made some first theory to this, because these layers are very thin. Maybe a remark here. I mean, what are these materials? Because you might wonder what this length is. This VF divided, or H bar VF divided by the exchange energy. Because if you would put the exchange energy of a ferromagnet, it's below an angstrom or something. Yeah, so it's zero. So this was one of the reasons maybe why it also was not found before in heterostructures, because what is the recent development is to use weak ferromagnets, for example, which are alloys, for example, palladium nickel, where palladium basically doped with nickel. We know palladium is close to instability to a ferromagnetic, and so if I just put a bit of nickel into it, it becomes ferromagnetic, and I can vary the ferromagnetism by changing this nickel concentration. So if I change it from 1 to 10%, for example, the TC of the Curie temperature, it goes from 0 to 100 Kelvin. And so this is, and then if you calculate now this corresponding length scale, you will find that it's in this range 1 or 10 nanometers, which is now in a much more a convenient range for these experiments, where you can really make homogeneous films of 10 nanometers or so. So this length x here is typically between 1 and 10 to 20 nanometers. So if you now insert real numbers again. But because this is so thin, we made a first model which explained this by using a so-called this picture of an Andreev state, which exists in a ballistic layer. And because it does not fully explain it, I just want to skip more or less through it. But I mean, we have this Andreev states, and you can explain this Andreev states are bound states below the gap of the superconductor, which consists of electron and hole pairs, which are in this ferromagnetic metal. And because of this ferromagnetism, you get this energy of this bound states in the gap region acquires also this additional shift, which is again this Q. And now we average again over all trajectories here. Yeah, and that's why we get kind of washed out oscillations, because yeah, and then we kind of could fit two of these curves roughly, but it's not a very good, because it does not really reproduce good the length dependence.
And how you make total Q equal zero for Andreev reflection? Reflections proceeds under those conditions, these conditions. Yeah. Usually in the Andreev reflection you give zero momentum to the condenser. And here, this ferromagnet, you cannot organize zero momentum transfer, because one electron is with up spin, the second with the down spin.
Okay.
So
yes.
What happens with
maybe
conservation?
Yeah. It's not fully correct to write it like this, because essentially you get bound states and you get they are split, they are spin split. So you get one state which is split up 2 plus 2 QL, and you get one state which is split down by minus 2 QL, so that the total number of is
because of the confinement in the film. Yes, it becomes possible. Yes.
Yes.
If it would be infinite Fermat, no?
Both electrons are not symmetric around the fermion.
Yes. In this sense, yeah.
But the condensate need to get zero momentum. So, and in ferromagnet, you cannot arrange zero momentum.
So no, you can. You can. You have one, say, one pair which is split by plus Q and or shifted by plus Q and one by minus Q. And this superposition of these two states give exactly this cosine Q, so this standing wave, right? Otherwise, you would have traveling waves.
Yes.
So you have a superposition of, I mean, this the order parameter is a superposition of all these pair states, and you have kind of always a kind of a splitting, yeah, which I didn't indicate here, like you have a plus 2QL and a minus 2QL states, and this depends actually on the spin, effectively.
Are the moments, the flux produced by the ferromagnet ever an issue in these experiments?
They are in the experiments an issue. In the theory, you want, of course, to avoid this. But it's a very, this is one important issue, actually, of the experiments, because, I mean, if you really want to make more complicated heterostructures with ferromagnets, which are, for example, non-collinear, and you want to switch ferromagnets, then, of course, you always have fields. You also change the total field configuration, and we know that the superconductors also just doesn't like the magnetic field. And so in the experiment, it's very important to get control over the magnetic structure and to avoid any fringe fields and so on. Yeah. Okay, so this was all I had to say about this density of states oscillation a year ago, and I want to later come back to this. But anyhow, the most important thing is that this is a real direct detection of this density of this oscillation in the structure of the Cooper pair with this exchange splitting. Now, I wanted to change the structure a little bit, in the sense that we now allow for a second superconductor. this, of course, because we want to look at the supercurrent now, the Josephson effect. And we know that we can again understand the Josephson effect in a way as similar to this bound state picture which I have shown you. You have this bound states which depend on energy. And what is new, if you add, say, a structure like this, so before we kind of looked at something where here's an insulating boundary and there's no transfer to the right. But if we have, for example, another superconductor here, then the energy of these bound states will also depend on the phase difference of this superconducting condensate, which I assume to be symmetric. And because it will travel for a certain time here, then during this traveling time, you will get an additional phase shift due to this exchange splitting, simply because you have to move for a certain time, and spin up and spin down evolve differently along this trajectory. So you get in the end, a phase shift which is exactly given by the length divided by this psi f. Okay, so this is the influence of the exchange splitting here. Now, to get from this picture of this bound states, which this Andreev bound states, one to the supercurrent, one can look at the following. So we have this bound state energies depend on this phase difference then, because each time we kind of make this loop, we pick up one of these phases. and these phase differences, and then the supercurrent is given by this relation that it's by the derivative of the Josephson energy with respect to the phase. And in some sense, you can view this as a similar to a band structure in a periodic lattice or somewhere where you have kind of the velocity the is given by the derivative of Josephson of energy with respect to momentum, and it's similar here. And now we can get from include this magnetism in a very simple manner, simply because we have seen we have this band split due to this ferromagnetism. So now we have this energy bands here, and now we just split these bands by this spin-dependent phase shift. So we have one band for spin up and one band for spin down, and they are shifted. They are shifted, or they have a phase difference of this of the order of this delta phi. So what I get for this energy is I get a band splitting, one with where the phase is added, this magnetic phase is added to the superconducting phase, one where it's subtracted, and I can view this as a band split, a spin splitting of this energy bands. Now, what does it mean for the total energy? So we have this cosine, for example, for a tunnel junction, we have this cosine phase dependence of a Josephson junction, and now we split it, which means we shift it in different directions, and then we add the amplitude again, and then we see that we get again a cosine, but we get it with a reduced amplitude, which is kind of the intuitive thing that the superconductivity is kind of reduced by this by the presence of this exchange field. But if we enhance this splitting this phase shift, then at some stage we will actually revert this cosine from this blue. So the blue curve is without magnetic, without exchange field. Then it's reduced in the green case. And if we have a phase shift of exactly pi over 2, then this Josephson energy is completely flat, which means that the supercurrent is zero for all phase difference. And if we further increase this phase shift, we actually get an inverted cosine. And then you see that this means actually that the current phase relation in this case is not the usual form proportional to sine of the phase difference, but it's proportional to minus sine of the phase difference times a prefactor IC, which depends on the which is the critical current, and this depends on this phase difference. So this is just the formula here for this which is plotted here. And the critical current, one can also view it as the critical current is modulated by cosine of this phase difference. So the critical current can change sign. Of course, this does not make sense because the critical current is by definition the maximal supercurrent, which I can sense through the junction, and this is always positive by definition. But one can make, of course, also phase sensitive experiments where one directly probes this sign of this supercurrent. Okay.
Yeah, so it seems like you can create a pure spin current here, if you like. In other words,
there's no spin current associated with this. It's you should not take it too serious that this is these bands are related directly to spin current. They are always carry kind of spin singlets, super Cooper pairs.
Is it better whether the ferromagnet is diffusive or ballistic or?
This was for a short junction. Then it doesn't matter. And it was, this is a very sketchy picture. Of course, in reality, it matters if it's diffusive or ballistic or short or long.
I'm saying this sort of picture survives even if you disorder spin orbits happening and so on.
It survives in the sense for each Andreev level. Okay, but of course, in a diffusive system, these levels are not clearly defined because you. Yeah, but I will come later to this. Okay. This was the kind of very simple picture. I also said this is for a tunnel junction, which assumes that the transmission is in some sense small, and only then I have this cosine energy bands. But we now generalize this to open contacts where we have we have transmissions which are not small with respect to 1, and then we get also again energy dependent bound states. This is similar to the previous case. Now we have also to include this superconducting phase difference, and here we have this spin dependent splitting of these bands.
Wolfgang, would you have to distinguish the spin up and spin down transmission?
Yeah, in general. This is again, one would have to include it, but we kind of made a simple model where you just assume that the transmission is the same, but you get this spin-dependent phase shift. So you could, for example, think about a thin ferromagnetic layer and then some small insulator which gives this finite transmission, but is independent of the spin. I will later argue that, then you have kind of separated this phase shift and this transmission. But it's again a simple. It's a bit involved. I mean, you get this many coupled equations and but I mean, this was just to get a simple picture, and we also assume we have one channel here, because of course you can average all this now over some Dorokoff distribution or what you want, but this was to calculate, because this is actually an observable quantity, for example, the temperature dependence of the critical current. And then you see that depending on this phase shift, you get a transition from this zero state to this pi state, which I didn't... So this is what we call a zero... pi transition, and so a zero is a normal Josephson junction where the usual current phase relation holds, and a pi junction is one where we have the opposite current phase relation. So the and because you can view it as a phase shift of pi in addition to the normal phase shift, that's why people call it a pi junction. And now, but how to observe it? For example, in this case, if we have open contact in the temperature dependence for a given phase shift, we can see that the critical current has this non-monotonic behavior. So in the normal BCS superconductor without this Josephson junction, without this phase shift, it just increases monotonically and saturates somewhere at zero temperature. And with this phase shift, you can have this non-monotonic temperature dependence, and in this limit, you actually get a sharp zero pi transition. So if you go along this line with the temperature, you exactly go in the previous plot from this cosine or minus cosine curve to this plus cosine curve, and then there's one temperature actually where this supercurrent exactly is zero for all phase differences. And if the junction is open, it's not so clear anymore, because the maximum supercurrent, you can have these transitions which are still show up here, but it's the current is not zero. It's just that the maximum is not at pi over 2 or minus pi over 2 anymore, but it's somewhere in between, and you can have multiple minima and maxima. Okay, so this is one of the things how this zero pi transition shows up in an observable, directly observable quantity. And this has actually been observed also like 5 years ago for the first time in now another of these weak ferromagnets. This is copper nickel. I think it's about a 50-50 mixture, which again is something which has a critical Curie temperature of, I don't know, 30 Kelvin, 50, 100 Kelvin in this ballpark. So it's again a weak ferromagnet in the sense that it has an exchange energy which is well, which is of a convenient order, so that this length scale, which one again calculates, is experimentally accessible. Okay, and this is this experimental first experimental result. Now we have actually better ones for different thicknesses, which corresponds in some sense to varying this phase shift. So df, you can it's not very good to see. This is df, the thickness varies here between 23 and 27 nanometers. It's actually not clear why there's such a sharp change, but I changed this layer thickness only by a few percent, and the critical current when it changes completely, it's actually theoretically not clear. So this fits are a bit, I mean, okay, if you look closely, you see that in this fits, the thickness is actually changed by a factor of 3. Yeah, and in this plot, it's just changed by, well, it's less than 20%. Yeah, but what you clearly see is this critical current as you go through the critical temperature. It first increases, then it goes down again, and it really at such a low, a certain temperature, it goes exactly to zero. Okay, so this has been experimentally confirmed. Now, this is how but this is not sensitive to the phase. For example, you don't know now if this bump is the plus phase or the is the zero phase or the pi phase. For this, you have to make a phase sensitive experiment, and this has been done in the group of Christoph Strunk in Regensburg in a very nice experiment, because one of the consequences of this pi phase shift is that if you form a superconducting loop where the weak link is made out of this Josephson junction, then you can obtain with this pi phase a spontaneous magnetic flux if the self-inductance of the loop is large enough. So this is shown here. So this is kind of a unique feature which only appears if you have this pi junction. So it's here explained. And this was actually directly observed in this experiment, where they kind of measured the magnetic flux, and you can see this corresponds to a zero phase, and then this curve is symmetric with respect to this point, which corresponds to a zero junction. And if there's already some kind of bias, self-biased flux in the junction, this whole pattern is shifted, and this is exactly what they observe here. So it's a very beautiful direct observation of this of this phase difference. Well, there are other ways how to observe it also by in an RF squid where it was also observed by other groups.
Have any of these experiments ever been done where the in region where the ferromagnetic transition temperature is below the superconducting one?
I think in this experiment by Ryazanov, I'm not so sure. Usually you want to have rather, but in this experiment by the Curie temperature is not much above the, it's like 20 Kelvin or something. But I think it becomes, okay, with this copper nickel, I don't know so well, but what I know with this palladium nickel, it's kind of, for very low concentrations, it's difficult to make a homogeneous, to get it's most difficult to control the magnetism for small concentrations. So they, yeah, for the lower TC, so it grows very rapidly. If you look at the X, it's this curves as a function of X, it is zero, and then it's, I think it's 3%, it suddenly increases very fast, and it's immediately like between 3 and 3.2% or 3.1%, it increases from 0 to 10 Kelvin, okay? And to control this concentration and homogeneously over the whole film is very difficult, and I think that's why it has not been done. But I think maybe there are other... Yeah. Okay. Okay, now I'm... let me see how far... Yeah, because I'm a bit, I wanted to come to the new part also, so maybe I will skip the third part of this this talk about the about this Kondo effect, because I'm just summarizes what I said here, and there's a whole bunch of theoretical works to explain various effects, but I wanted to skip now to basically the summary, and to come to one point which is actually interesting in this field about this zero pi transition, because it turns actually out that in this theory, I've shown you this plot where you saw this this comparison with the theory and the experiment, which was not very good because the length dependence was completely out of date. But there's another thing is that this simple theory actually predicts a zero pi transition in the sense that if you go from zero at the lower temperature to a pi phase at the higher temperature, and what is experimentally observed is exactly the opposite. So this is kind of, and there was no way to fit this these parameters, or to changing the parameters to fit this. And this is something we did now and in the last year, and to explain this. And this is what I wanted to discuss now, because then I also have to want to discuss something new. and because we use, this is talk by Audrey Côté, and we use incompatible programs, namely LaTeX and PowerPoint, so I have to change the kind of transformation, but still I can make here this kind of thing, right? Let's see what happens. Okay. Okay, so we were looking at this problem again, and I summarize again some of the data, and so this data I've shown you already. Now adding some more data, and they at this time they were not able to determine whether it's the zero or the pi phase. But in this experiment, in another experiment, also Contos et al. Were able to measure this curve now not as a function of this temperature, but as a function of this layer thickness, again using this palladium nickel. So this, I mean, each point is a separate sample, so you know they really have grown many samples. And they were able to detect also this as a function of this thickness of the ferromagnet, the phase, and they found that this is a zero phase, and this is the pi phase. And this density of states oscillations is also something which in principle is, we have also positive or negative values, and in some sense this corresponds a bit to the zero and pi phase, if you want. And this is again this experiment, and also here, I didn't show this, but the theory, let's say prediction for this curve, which is not the curve, plotted here, actually also goes the opposite in this regime. Yeah. So, and this is again to mention this experiments by Bauer and Al, where they observed this, but don't want to go. Just to mention that they determined this also. Yeah, but so there is some. So these curves which are plotted here are just plotted by the experimentalists. Plot some curve which fits the which looks like what they would like to have. But these are not, let's say, a theory curves. And so we now use this quasi-classical theory which. I don't want to explain here. I mean, some formulas have been shown to you in this talk by Jaroslav, where he talked about this magnetization, this generalization of this Landau-Lifshitz equation. This was also quasi-classical equations. And I don't want to go into details, but one thing I wanted to mention is that one has to generalize these boundary conditions, and this is why I particularly want to mention it here, because there's actually a parameter appearing here, this imaginary part of the mixing conductance, which appeared many times yesterday. And in this superconducting business, the boundary conditions are a bit more complex. I don't want to go into details. And this first part, for example, is quite old, and this assumes spin-degenerate interfaces. And there have been now kind of generalizations to include this spin dependence, and you see, well, maybe this doesn't tell you too much, but you see at least that the formula is three times as long, so it's much more complicated. And if you would not have all these nice abbreviations, it would look even more ugly. But it's the most important thing is that it's kind of these interfaces are characterized by a few parameters. Actually, in the following, we want to neglect most of them because one can argue that they are small and so on. If we have no spin dependence, then actually there's only one parameter characterizing this interface in this case, in this limit, which we assume here a weakly transparent interface. And namely, it's only the total conductance which matters, the conductance per area, if you want. Yeah, and this is just given by the sum over the transmission eigenvalues and so on, multiplied with the conductance quantum. Yeah, and there's another parameter characterizing the spin dependence of this interface. And if you look at the first part, this is exactly this imaginary part of the mixing conductance. There's another part here which also depends on the spin dependence. But in the end, they appear in this combination, and we I mean, we cannot distinguish now this term or this term. So it just appears in this combination times some parameter which depends on the magnetization of the ferromagnet. And okay, again, I don't want to go any details. And just to say that this we call this the phase shifting conductance, because as you will see in a second, it will lead to an additional phase shift in this. In these quantities. Okay, but this is just one has to generalize these boundary conditions and things get a bit more complicated. But if one does all this and now recalculates, and this has not been done in previous calculations of this density of states oscillations and supercurrent critical current calculations. And I mean, in some simplified limit, which is actually experimentally relevant, we are now looking at the supercurrents through the ferromagnetic layer with two tunnel contacts actually to the superconductor, which is kind of natural. They do not really fit to each other, and all this is also quite disordered, so that this is almost like a tunnel contact. And then finally the result we obtain for this is the critical current normalized in some way depending now, and this is mainly the thickness dependence D here. Okay, D is the thickness of the ferromagnet. Here we have this xi f, and now you see a kind of different terms. This sine d over xi f is again this oscillation you have without this new term in the boundary conditions. This is just because of the thickness of the ferromagnet. But here's an additional phase shift which depends, okay, in some complicated way on exactly this phase shifting conductance, so this imaginary part of the mixing conductance. And this leads to a phase shift of this oscillations. And to see it more directly, we have plotted here now the what follows from this formula for the critical current for keeping all parameters the same. This characterizes somehow the tunnel junction, or maybe the important parameter here is this, which is the ratio of the imaginary part of the mix, of this phase shifting conductance and the tunnel conductance. So this is kind of the parameter. If this is small, then we can forget about the spin dependence of the interface. and then we would not have. Then this phase shift here would of course be absent. Okay, and this just shows you now this kind of effect that it's really a phase shift, that we have this oscillation, and depending on how we modify this gamma, it has of course more effect. It's not just a phase shift, it also affects the magnitude, but it shifts this minimum, for example, back and forth. And now it's clear that we can kind of go for a given position. For example, here, by varying this gamma, we can go from a zero to a pi junction and vice versa. Okay? But now one of the crucial tests is, can we really describe the experiments? And the answer is yes, we can. And furthermore, we can describe two different experiments which measure different quantities, namely the supercurrent. Sorry for this. I messed up. This is another incompatibility between Windows and Mac, I suppose. So we can. This is the critical current, so the supercurrent, and this is this density of states measurement, which are completely. They are different samples, but the same material. And what we find is now by using this gamma phi parameter as a fitting parameter, that we can fit both curves consistently with roughly the same value. So we kind of find that this is a parameter which is characteristic for this material, which is a contact between niobium on one side and palladium nickel on the other side. This is what we found out here by using these fits. And just to compare this now shows our fit using for this parameter some value -1.3. We also obtain the correct sign in the sense that we have a zero junction here and a pi junction here for larger thicknesses. And if we take for the same other parameters but changing setting this to zero, we see that we also get the opposite, let's say, order of this transition. So it's a pi phase, pi junction here, and it's a zero junction here. But of course, one could improve this fit by changing other parameters, which are not clear. But one can never get such a good agreement with here. And we are confident that this is has really something to do with. I mean that there's something generic, because we can fit these different experiments of a different a quantity using roughly the same parameter, and also here you get just the opposite kind of behavior from this fit without this phase shifting conductance of. So this was basically the end, I just wanted to conclude to say that we have developed a theory where this interface, this magnetic interface between magnetic material and the superconductor is characterized by these two parameters, the tunneling conductance and this phase shifting conductance, and then this leads to this to a shift of the phase of this oscillations of the spatial variations of the order parameter, and it's in agreement with experiments in palladium nickel. And so with this I wanted to thank you for your attention.
Normally this mixing conductance shows only up in the non-collinear magnetism.
Right.
Where are these?
Here it shows up.
Yeah, but why? I mean, there's just one ferromagnet.
Yes, but it shows up. It basically, because you have a phase-sensitive experiment, because if you think about two electrons, a Cooper pair, which is reflected, then you get kind of a different phase, because it's a spin singlet. You get kind of a phase shift, which then translates into a phase shift of the orbital part. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the same you have in this. Single
nanotubes,
which
would be
also
true. Yeah, but then
you also got effects in the collinear situation, which you wouldn't get if you had time to diffuse.
What's the
significance? Sir? Because you have, if you have this Fabry-Perot interferometer, then the bounced, say the resonance energies depend, of course, also on the phase shifts at the interface, and they are different for spin up and spin down. So you get kind of different energies, different resonances for spin up and spin down, and this of course shows up also in a collinear. Sorry. No. It's a property of the kind of interface, which of course, if you connect a nanotube to a ferromagnet, is even more. You don't know what really happens. Yeah. But so it's some effective parameter. But it's just the fact that it's in general it should be there. You should have different reflection phases for the two spins, right? I mean, why should they be the same? Well, in general, you know, spin orbit, of course, has no effect on the superconducting property because it's a time reversal.
It can introduce you to like kind of non-diagonal elements and scattering matrix, and then you cannot speak just about this kind of mixing conductance.
Yeah. I would expect that in this diffusive system you would not expect much change. Maybe you would everything is lumped together in this parameter. Yeah? But in this picture where we have kind of one channel, then I think it would matter. Mm-hmm. Because as you say, then you would get off diagonal terms, and you would okay, I don't know what the precise effect would be. I mean, you would get more splittings of these bound states eventually.
But actually, spin orbit in the surface layers of semiconductors mixes singlets and triplets.
Okay.
Thanks.
Singlet and triplet.
There is no more classification.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yes. That's the effect on semiconductors and on superconductors. And I don't know whether it can manifest itself in the experiments of your kind. But
there's a theoretical paper by Chelkachev and Nazarov where they kind of predict that you have an additional splitting of states due to spin orbit interaction. They consider also a one-dimensional channel where you have kind of, you know, back where you have spin orbit interaction. But I don't know.
So where are things going from now? I think you have now perfect agreement with experiments. But what are the challenges? What is the future of SF? Should we work on this or?
No, not all. I mean, this is I think there are many experiments to be done because this is not really, everything is not so really good under very good control, right? I mean, so what has not been done, for example, are experiments where you kind of can. Switch the magnetism, where you have now two different ferromagnets and you can, for example, switch the change the orientations of the magnetizations.
But this is all sort of within the quasi-classical theory. It's a rather straightforward extension of
it. Well, yeah. Well, yeah, okay, many things are straightforward because it's in the end just quantum mechanics, yeah. Yeah, but yeah, I think it would be nice to have the combination of your transport equation and the Husserl equation, and including the superconductivity.
But if you have a triplet superconductor, I mean, would that be interesting somehow? You could have spin kernels in everything.
But there are works, of course. Triplet superconductors are. I mean, either they are P-wave, then they are sensitive to impurities and surface scattering and so on, which of course, it's theoretically no problem. You just forget this order, but experimentally it's of course a big problem if you want to make heterostructures, you want to make clean interfaces. But there are, okay, there's an, I think there's a very interesting experiment related to this. There are these predictions about and I only have the I only have just the paper here, so maybe and is this so which is really not understood, yeah. So they have measured a supercurrent through a half-metallic ferromagnet, chromium dioxide. Yeah, so this is really not understood because there's definitely no spin singlet in chromium side. So how can it? And this is just an S-wave. They have S-wave superconductors. Okay, here's a sample. Yeah, this is just a normal. Should I? Is it visible? I mean, this is just some niobium, TIN, I don't, titan nitride, I don't know. Yeah. so just an S-wave superconductor, and they measure the supercurrent between these two. Yeah.
Are the critical currents very small? So small or not?
Let me check. I guess it is small, yeah. Well, it depends on the size of the junction, right? I mean, here the critical current is milliampere, but of course these are huge junctions, right? Okay, so this is something which is just not understood. There are some theories which predict some triplet order parameters which can be induced by combining non-collinear magnets and superconductors, because you can just view that. I mean, if you have some non-collinear magnetization, that this singlet is transformed into a triplet somehow. Yeah. But it's not clear, for example, where this non-homogeneous magnetization should be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, also this thing is probably not. Maybe it's not one domain, or I don't know. Yeah. There are open
That's
questions.
It's not a perfect half now. Right.
It's not. I don't know.
Not a perfect half.
Yeah. So what is? They claim it. Yeah.
That's very important in this world. It's a bit of an half. Otherwise, it's just trivial.
There's never a perfect half metal at non-zero temperature, as the magnetization fluctuates.
And at 1.6 Kelvin, or?
Yeah.
So would you expect some?
What is the temperature dependence?
It's here.
So it gets bigger at lower temperatures.
Okay. Yeah.
It doesn't go back down. I agree. So that's not the explanation.
Okay, but I must say that I just don't know too much about chromium dioxide. I just know that there are some theories, and they use some. Okay, this is transmitted in the world, so I don't make too much sense.
Yeah. Oh.
So how about the use of these pi junctions for quantum computation? There's also some talk about that.
Well, I mean, you can every two-state system use as a. I mean, these flux qubits are, of course, kind of they include an artificial pi junction, yeah, by this triple Josephson junction and putting some flux and so on, you can create an pi junction. So, of course, you
without applying magnetic field, basically.
Exactly.
There were a bunch of papers though on setting up a pi junction in a loop, and trying to remember who the authors were. Couple years ago, but they appeared in this article in Science, but they wanted to say it was going to be more noise isolated since you weren't actually getting, you're just getting a phase shift and not actually a microscopic current.
I think this is a question to the experimentalists to get this kind of flux qubit by just conventional junction required. A lot of expertise of the Delft group and other groups to fabricate all these junctions and to exactly, as they have to be very exact and so on and so on, and this level of expertise is definitely not reached in this business here. Yeah? So they have not such a good control, and if they, as usually you show all the critical currents you have measured, but you don't show the samples where you have just measured nothing, right?
Ferromagnets to make entangled
pairs,
right?
You don't. In the ferromagnet, you project the spin, right? So.
Yeah, but there have been ideas of sort of attaching two ferromagnetic antiparallel oriented ferromagnets onto the superconductor. And let one Cooper pair go into the one and the other.
Yeah, but this is not spin entangled anymore because it's projected onto spin, to the majority spin, say, on this side and on that side, and then it's not entangled anymore.
Uh-huh.
But for example, to detect entanglement, you could kind of use kind of ferromagnetic contacts, but this is independent of the superconductors, right? Okay. Time for coffee.